I would like to introduce our speaker, Natalie Sambi, to present Back from the Barracks, Why Indonesia's Military Still Reigns Supreme. Thanks, Natalie.
Thank you so much, Amy. Thank you so much to the AIAA WA's committee. It's lovely to be back in my hometown. Thank you, everybody, for making time to come out tonight as well. So just to quickly explain what VEB Research does, it was my goal to set up a small organisation that filled a gap within the think tank architecture to start to help people understand in greater depth and with greater nuance the relationship between militaries and societies in Southeast Asia. That is, after all, our closest strategic neighbourhood, and it is an area where we need to pay greater attention. And so that was my aim, to bring together a group of dynamic young people who understand the region, who speak the languages, who've lived there, to try and produce research that helps not only the public better understand those dynamics within those countries, but also help inform policy and government as well. So what I wanted to talk about today is why I think the Indonesian military still reigns supreme in what is essentially a post-authoritarian, democratic Southeast Asian country. And I want to talk a little bit about why should we bother with understanding why the military reigns supreme? How can we explain its pervasive role throughout Indonesian politics and society? And ultimately, what does that mean for Indonesia? And obviously for the Australian Institute of International Affairs, what does that matter for Australia? So just quickly speaking, when I talk about Indonesia, just to give you a sense of the sheer scale of the country, it's a country of 260 million people. That's 10 times the population of Australia, spread across 17,000 islands. Of course, of great ethnic, religious, and racial diversity as well. And it's had that national identity only since 1945, so even younger than Australia. In terms of national challenges, Indonesians earn on average just under $6,000 per year, and the poverty rate is about 10% at a moderate estimate. So that's the entire population of Australia. As I said earlier, it's the largest state in Southeast Asia, and it's a great country to our north. It's of great strategic significance to the region, being not only the world's third largest democracy, but it's also an economy that's growing incredibly. It's growing at about 5% per annum per year. And just because I love maps, I just want to point out the strategic position of Indonesia, located between the nexus of the Indian and the Pacific Oceans. This is a map from the Australian government that demonstrates all of the maritime trade routes, and you can see the significance there of the trade routes that go through the Indonesian archipelago. That in itself should be a reason why Australia ought to pay more attention to what happens in Indonesia, not only around in its waters, but in its borders as well. And obviously, just another point to think about, when Indonesia looks north, what it sees is a great region of a strategic change, where you've got the Indian military also starting to build up as well, the Chinese, the PLA obviously growing in strength there, and obviously this new strategic construct of the Indo-Pacific, the South China Sea and so forth. So again, Indonesia has a very different strategic outlook as Australia's, but it's incumbent upon us to understand where it's coming from. So within the Indonesian state, obviously our topic of today is the Indonesian military, just to give you a little bit of a potted history where the military's come from. It sprang out of the War of Independence as a conglomerate of formerly Dutch, Japanese trained troops and also a bunch of irregular fighters as well. It's one of its earliest and most important events was the crushing of an attempted coup in September, October 1965, after which the military was involved in the killings of about 500,000 to about a million people. And that still has not been properly acknowledged by the military, but it has become one of those foundational experiences of the Indonesian state. General Suharto formally took power in March 1966. The original document has never been found until he resigned in May 1998 after great social and economic turmoil after the East Asian financial crisis. And so the disgraced military not only withdrew from politics, but then started a process of internal reform. And that was when Indonesia started to become a democracy. So we're in 2020 now. Indonesia's democracy is 22 years old, thereabouts, and still a very different kind of democracy to others around the world. To continue on about the story of the Indonesian military, the police then separated. When you look at the security actors within the Indonesian state, yes, the military was paramount, but after the Bali bombings, the police started to get more funding, were starting to be trained by Australians and Americans, and they have their crack counterterrorism team known as Detachment 88. And since 2002 has been leading a lot of the anti-terrorist operations there, has successfully dealt with Jemaah Islamiyah and other groups. The military's role waned after the end of its military operations in East Timor, and after negotiations were signed in 2005, and Aceh really didn't have a lot to do. So the president from 2004 to 2014, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, himself a former general, thought that it's best to keep the military occupied by pushing them into roles like peacekeeping and trying to push further reform. But a lot of those reform processes have been limited. So we'll see where that's come today. So we've had a military that was quite involved in the Indonesian state for much of the 20th century, democratization in 1998, attempts at reform and keeping the military busy. But where do we end up today? So the military of today is about 400,000 people. The army is the largest service, followed by the Navy, Air Force, and the Marines. It's going to spend this year about $15 billion. Just to give you an example, we spend double that, more than double that on our defense force, and that's to do a lot with the high-end capability that we have. We don't nearly have the size of the Indonesian military, but within the Indonesian military's budget, a lot of that money goes to army personnel and maintaining the professionalization of the land force. If you think back to that map, we're talking about an archipelago here, but again, a lot of that money is going to the army, which is interesting. And the last point I want to say that is unique to the Indonesian military is that it has this pervasive presence throughout the archipelago. That's not like the Australian Defence Force. We don't have soldiers everywhere throughout our cities and through our villages, but in Indonesia, the situation is a little bit different. You have a shadow structure that's like the civilian government. You have a regional head, a district head, a local head, and then you have an NCO hanging around the village. Again, not like something we see in Australia, but very particular to Indonesia, and we'll see why. So get to the topic today. What does it mean when I say the Indonesian military still reigns supreme? My argument is that Indonesian military personnel, both active and retired, continue to exert a disproportionate, a much higher level of influence in areas of the state and in the people's lives that is beyond the demands of a post-authoritarian democratic state military. Very big mouthful. In other words, the military is doing a lot of stuff that you wouldn't expect a military to do, putting it in plain English. And what it means is in a democratic society like ours and a lot of post-authoritarian states as well, we would assume greater civilian control over the military, and we would expect the military to stay in their barracks, to do their job, be a security force. So why isn't that quite the case in Indonesia? So what I've done, I grabbed a bunch of headlines from a lot of newspaper articles over the last couple of years that is demonstrative of the military's creeping role outside of security. For one, there's been demanding positions in civilian roles, signing of MOUs and doing tasks that are not quite what a military should be doing, confiscating books, we've seen that throughout the 20th century, attempts to actually change the military's role in legal terms as well, and then also the last headline there is this idea that the Indonesian military still has a sense of impunity, that they're not actually going to be treated under the law as they ought to be when they've been doing things that are things like extrajudicial killings. So again, how does the military reign supreme? It's this involvement that expands beyond its traditional security role. So I'll just break down these areas that I'm going to talk about today, where I think the military is going beyond where it should. Number one, politics. Number two, civilian life. Number three, where it's infringing on the role of the police, and four, that continued culture of impunity. So here we've got the man who currently runs the country, President Joko Widodo, who's a former governor of Jakarta. He's a civilian that came to the role in 2014, but he doesn't currently have a background in military affairs. And what that's meant is that he's delegated a lot of the thinking about defence and security issues to former military generals, particularly army generals as well. So this is exemplified by the fact that one of his key advisors, Luhut Binsar Panjaitan, is a former Special Forces general. He's had a lot of business deals with Jokowi and has been a senior minister in the cabinet. So let's have a look at what some of those cabinet posts look like. So what I've done is I've taken a table out of some of the key military, former military officers. I know the names are going to be a bit confusing there. What I want you to focus on, two things. The services, all of them come predominantly from the army. These are the ones who have got portfolios overseas, and what those positions are. So for instance, you've got the Minister for Defence, you've got the Coordinating Minister for Maritime Affairs and Investment, Minister for Internal Affairs, who is a former police general, the Minister for Religion, Chief of Staff, and Minister for Health, but then also other key members around the President. These are the people who form the inner circle who are advisors to the President. A lot of these people have been socialized in an army mindset. And a lot of these people have been around during the New Order period. If you look at the date in which they joined the military academies, 1974, 1970, 97, that's decades under Suharto's Indonesia. That's decades within that socialization process as well. And what I'm particularly interested in is this man. Does anybody know who this man is? Prabowo, exactly. This man was Jokowi's key presidential rival in the last election. He is now the Minister for Defence. That would be the equivalent of, who's our Prime Minister at the moment? Scott Morrison, getting an Anthony Albanese as your Defence Minister. This is an extraordinary development to invite a political rival to hold a key portfolio within the Cabinet. And we can talk a little bit about why that happened, but what I want to highlight is that this man, a former general, has a background of concern in terms of human rights abuses. He was a close, not a family member, of the former president, but now has been given the responsibility in a post-authoritarian democratic state that is supposed to have civilian control. Again, so in that inner circle. So another area I want to highlight is where I think the military has been going beyond its mandate is this idea of its role in civilian life. Just last year, the Ministry of Education and Culture signed an agreement with the military that soldiers would become teachers. That's a really interesting development. They said, oh, well, you know, the soldiers actually have the right to teach discipline, they can read, so that's appropriate. It says very much about what civilian teaching capacity is like in Indonesia, but it also says something about the ability to be able to develop that as well if you're using soldiers to fill the gaps. Again, other kinds of areas of military encroachment, the fact that Jokowi has increased the pay for these village-level NCOs shows that this territory system, this territory presence, isn't going anywhere anytime soon. In fact, they're strengthening under Jokowi. As I pointed out, is one of the newspaper headlines earlier, the military chief signed a memorandum of understanding with Freeport MacMoran, you know, one of the biggest mines in the Papuan province, for Indonesian military to provide security as private security contractors. And again, there's a glut of mid-ranking and high-ranking officers in the Indonesian military that will be taking up civilian posts within Indonesian bureaucracy as well. Again, this encroachment of the military in areas that probably shouldn't be in. Again, it's an example of, you know, soldiers in the classroom. The other area, again, shaping public discourse. When you have a military that is not willing to talk about the things that it did in its past, again, in an open democratic state, we have a problem, because that means that the ability for the military to account for the human rights abuses that it committed, the kinds of killings that it undertook in its name of in defense of the state, cannot be accounted for. So there has been active cases where retired military officers have been suppressing public discussion about its role in 1965, 1966, and also saying that there continues to be a communism threat. And when you have retired personnel and active personnel saying that, okay, there is a continued communism threat that does something to the way in which people are thinking in society, it gives them the ability to say, okay, we need the military to look after us. They've done it before. So again, these are some of the effects of this military having this ability to be able to shape that public discourse as well. And of course, Jokowi was going to investigate some of these killings and has since stepped back from that. Now, the other area of encroachment, I would argue, is this rivalry with the police. Now, as I said earlier, after the Bali bombings, the police had this very special role in counterterrorism. And since that time, has been law enforcement led. But the military has been calling for a greater and greater role in terms of dealing with the terrorism threat. There have been senior military figures that have been calling for this role, and ultimately it's going to be changed under law that the military has this expanded role, and there's been a new special forces headquarters also set up to be able to deal with this. So again, under Jokowi's watch, a lot of these developments, this creeping in civilian role, creeping in politics, now dealing with the police as well. And just to hammer home this point about the continuing culture of impunity, since 1998 until 2020, there have been no major human rights prosecutions for any of the acts committed by the Indonesian military in areas like Timor, Aceh, or Papua, or any of the mysterious disappearances of people known as Petrus. Just quickly, there's one case that happened in 2013. A Special Forces sergeant was bashed at a nightclub in Yogyakarta near Sleman. A bunch of gangsters were rounded up and put into a prison. Mysteriously, security cameras go out, and masked men enter the prison and shoot up all of the gangsters, execution style. Lo and behold, an investigation shows that they were special forces officers, special forces NCOs and officers that orchestrated the killings. This is absolutely outrageous that soldiers would use their training to go and execute gangsters in a retaliation for the beating up of one of their colleagues. It's extraordinary that they would break into a police jail as well. And so what happens? They go under trial, and for the extrajudicial killings done, being trained as special forces soldiers, they get 6 and 11 years. So by 2020, some of these guys would be out by now. And again, this reinforces the idea that these soldiers are above the law, that the military should be given special treatment. Here is a member of the public going to go thank one of the soldiers for cleaning up the city. Again, a complicated picture because organized crime is a problem in Yogyakarta, but public support for the military saying thank you. So how do we explain all of this? So what I've outlined at the beginning of this presentation is all the different ways that the military is playing this bloated role in areas like politics, in civilian society, against the police, and it continues this culture of impunity. But why is this still happening? Why in post-authoritarian Indonesia do we still find this case? And I think there are some structural drivers I want to point to. As I said earlier, the physical presence of the military throughout the archipelago does certainly raise that contact with the society. The fact that there are too many personnel is one other issue. The entrenched interests of individuals and corporate interests of the military in keeping engaged in a lot of these areas, making sure a lot of their wealth and their power is reinforced. And as I said earlier, there are now legal changes that are allowing the military to hold on to some of this power. But I would say it's not just the case that it's structural drivers that are keeping the military in place, that are keeping the military with such pervasive powers throughout Indonesian politics and society. I would actually say it's a question of beliefs. I mean, even as I'm talking, I'm espousing a belief that military should not have this much influence in a society in a place like Indonesia. But that's coming from a normative belief of the way civil military relations should be organized in a democratic state. But it is also the case in Indonesia that the military has its own set of beliefs about itself. And society has its own beliefs about the military that I would argue play a very important part of why the military reigns supreme today. So let's take the military side of things. And one thing I want to talk about and highlight is this idea of role identification. Since the beginning of the Indonesian state, the Indonesian military has told itself it is the guardian of the nation. It is its rightful place to be in politics and society. In fact, it was actually doctrine for the Indonesian military to be involved in things other than security. So in order to return itself into the state of glory and its state of power, it is involving itself in a lot of these areas. And again, it's this belief that has been borne out over the 20th century, whether factually correct or not, is this idea that they're more capable than civilians. And we'll see what that perception is like on the civilian side in a moment. But for now, when you speak to military officers to say, we know how to run the country, we do a better job, and therefore we will take those roles as well. Not necessarily in a nefarious sense, but certainly in a very pragmatic mindset. And again, the fact that they had such influence during the New Order period, having seats mandated in parliament, also reinforces this mindset for people who were socialized under the New Order that this was ours and we're going to take it back. So again, like I said, the structural reasons, I think, in this case, reinforce this sociocultural belief that the military belongs to the people have this special relationship, and therefore the military should continue to have these pervasive roles. Again, I love talking about beliefs and identity. And again, a lot of who we think we are is predicated on what we remember, what we did. And I think in this case for the Indonesian military, concepts like collective memory are actually quite instructive. And how you remember how you lived your life, particularly for military, the story it tells itself, I think it forms a lot of the way it thinks about its own role and its beliefs in society. And just borrowing from some of the academic literature there, it's an older work, but it forms the basis of a lot of thinking about strategic and military culture, is that a lot of the formative and foundational and formative events mark a group of people. So often in the case of a national narrative, it's like the founding of the nation or the collective trauma or something like the Holocaust that defines a group of people. So in the case of the Indonesian military, it's that collective memory. So again, that foundational event being that being born out of the War of Independence, coming together as a military force, and the formative role that the Indonesian military has played in a lot of the internal domestic security threats gives us a socialization that we belong within the borders. Our role is within the borders, within the state of Indonesia. Again, not unusual for a lot of militaries in Southeast Asia, where the military has often played a role fighting communists. Even today in the Philippines, you have the Philippines army fighting against communists. Again, in Thailand, dealing with a lot of domestic threats as well. Whether it's right or wrong, it is the history of each of these militaries, and it is the history that is coming to bear on these militaries today. Now, I particularly like this slide because it's in a nutshell. Can anyone tell me why there is one line in red? Mark, you can answer if you want. Ah, who said that? No, not that one. Yes, thank you. So these are major operations fought by the Indonesian military and, you know, during occupation as well. But this is the formative experience of the Indonesian military in a nutshell. And the only thing that extended beyond its borders was konfrontasi. And that was something the military didn't even want to do. So when you have a military and armed forces that is only dealt with terrorism, separatism, insurgency, what do you think the mindset of the military is? Their job is at home, not across the borders. And so when they think and they remember these experiences, what do? They look at the loss and sacrifice. So this is an excerpt of the Saroja Monument at TNI headquarters, the military's headquarters in Jakarta that I visited a couple of times. And it commemorates the Indonesian military's sacrifice, their narrative, their beliefs about what happened in East Timor. And these are all the names of people that died in 1975 that were in the Indonesian military or the volunteers as well. And every panel of this monument has these names. If you can imagine something like the cenotaph that we've got in King's Park with the names of people that died in particular conflicts. Indonesian military has the same. We don't see it. But any visiting foreign military delegation or Indonesian military will see this every time they go to headquarters. It's huge. It's 32 walls, if you can imagine. And the explanation that it gives for what it did in Timor, you can see the sufferings of the East Timor people in the Portuguese colonization. Well, you know, in Australia, our interpretation of what happened is that the military rolled in 1975 and killed a lot of Timorese people and occupied the province for 24 years. The Indonesian military's interpretation, their belief, is that we went to alleviate internal fighting between Timorese political groups and we helped try and develop the province and incorporate it into the national state of Indonesia for 24 years. So it is important for us to understand the difference in interpretation between what the Indonesian military sees as its historical role and how that comes to bear on its present role. And why does that matter? Who knows who this guy is on the right? He look familiar? That's Prabowo Subianto. This is him as a young Kopassus officer in Timor. This is a man that did a lot of his operational deployments in that province. This is a man who is socialized for having a deep emotional attachment to a province the Indonesian military lost. Who's this guy? The guy in the middle, also a special forces captain. This was a man who also had the majority of his operational deployments in East Timor. This was a man that actually did the initial jump from the C-130s by parachute into Timor. And this is him today. This is Luhut Binsar Panjaitan, who is Jokowi's right-hand man, key business partner and coordinating minister for maritime affairs and investment. These are the men that surround the president. This is the socialization of these people who have the idea that a province of Indonesia was taken from them wrongfully or rightfully, wrongfully in their minds. And you can read these interpretations in a lot of these places. This is where their collective memory resides. And you can see how they're thinking about the world again. So this is, in my view, some of the reinforcement of those beliefs within the military about who they are, what they remember, and therefore what they should do today. And again, like this idea of never again is one of those beliefs that has permeated their thinking collectively. The other reason I think some of this will endure is that a lot of those people that I pointed out before have family that will continue to shape the Indonesian military and politics today. So just pointing out one key one is General A.M. Hendra Priyono, who used to be head of the intelligence agency. I think he's come out to Australia many times. Also has a background of human rights abuse and suspected of murdering human rights activist Munir, who was on a flight to the Netherlands. His son is going to be chief of army and then probably going to be chief of the military as well. And Luhut Binsar Panjaitan, who we saw in the previous photo, his son was also a general of Kopassus, of special forces. Again, you've got this next generation. And I've actually gone to talk to people about the military academy education. And I've said, okay, you've got this older generation who've been socialized under the new order. You've got their next generation who are their sons and not so many of their daughters who are now coming up the ranks. What about your cadets? Are you teaching them about history? Are you teaching them about democratic process? And they're like, no, not really. So again, there's this kind of like reinforcement of a particular sets of beliefs given instructors at these kinds of institutions are a particular generation as well. So that's on the military side. That's all of the stuff that's brewing within the TNI itself. Yeah, but what does that mean? Does society actually agree with them? Does that actually have any kind of impact on the way in which society perceives the military? I would argue yes. And it's not just because society loves the military. There have been lots of factors there that have reinforced the military's self-importance in the eyes of the public. And first of all is that they controlled the education system from 1965 onwards. The Armed Forces History Centre actually controlled the history textbooks that were being produced, the depictions in the museum, and any of the propaganda films that were made around that time. And I'll talk about a little bit about museums in a second, but also, as I said earlier, the visibility of the military. When you have soldiers hanging around your village all the time when you're a kid, you're going to have this particular view of the military, that they're there, they're innocuous, they're helping us, they're in our place, they're actually doing things for us. So there's a bit of positive reinforcement and this idea that the military, the belief that the military is actually a beneficial force. I will say quickly, though, that it is not always the case in Indonesia when we see support from the military that it is genuine. Yes, there are genuine amounts of support, and we'll talk about that in a second, but I do want to point out that the military does actively promote itself, like everybody does on Twitter and Facebook, but quite aggressively so on social media campaigns, misinformation, disinformation campaigns, aggressively on social media platforms, and they did this recently in Papua provinces. So I'll flag that. We can talk about that a little bit in the Q&A, but that's just a little bit of a thing that's done particularly for foreign audiences, but it is still the case that the Indonesian military remains very popular within society. Again, one of the most trusted institutions, and I'll just click ahead to this one. I just did a quick collection of all the major public pollings that was done. It's not unusual, of course, for the public to have a favourable view of militaries, but year after year after year, the military comes out on top, higher than the president, higher than the Corruption Eradication Commission, and higher than the police, lowest on the rank, political parties. But the ratings are astounding. Anywhere is a minimum, I think, of 70% to an approval rating of about 94%. Year after year by a number of actually trusted polling institutions as well. These aren't just all biased, military biased institutions. Some of these are very well respected. CSIS Indonesia in particular, an independent think tank there as well. So again, a lot of that public support for that military recorded there. And part of that can be explained by nostalgia. Nostalgia is a longing for the way things used to be and when people knew their place. Has a very rough definition. It's my favorite definition from Brené Brown. And that nostalgia for the past is borne out by the fact that people are still longing for a sense of order and a sense of justice with the way they understand it, because there are times where for them democracy seems messy. When you have a democracy and you have a robust media, what you're getting in Indonesia are headlines every day of corruption cases. Corruption of politicians, corruption of police, corruption of business people. And so for some in Indonesian society, there's this idea, well, democracy, is it worth the cost? We liked it better under Suharto, maybe. And I'm not saying that's everybody, but I'm just saying that there are perceptions coming out now, beliefs that it was better in the good old days. And again, we've got memes coming out for the Javanese speakers in the audience. Dave, help me out. Piara Kabare says, how's it going? Like, how's it going right now? And there have been other memes where it's Suharto being like, you miss me now? So again, it's interesting. And if there's any more evidence of that, one of the other points is that 44.5% of eligible voters at the last election who turned out were willing to vote a former general, Prabowo Subianto, with a background of human rights concern, because in him they saw someone who could run the country. Again, so some of that nostalgia is there. So I touched a little bit about education. I just want to drill down a little bit further in how the military is presenting itself and how that's being received by society. I've been into the military museum before, and General Suharto's uniform, the display for him, totally pristine. The rest of the military, rest of the museum falling apart. But there's an idea there when you're a young person, a student, going through like, this guy must have been really awesome. This guy must have been really special. And a lot of that's because the military museums are still run by the Armed Forces History Centre, which is run by a brigadier. Now, the Australian War Memorial, the head of the War Memorial is a civilian appointee. They've got committees. They are separate from the Australian Department of Defence. They may receive some funding from that, but they are a separate entity. It is not the case in Indonesia. The Armed Forces History Centre actually is part of the Indonesian military structure. And like I said, it has been a brigadier rank since the beginning. So again, in a recent trip to Jakarta, I went to go visit the museum at the National Monument. And again, lots and lots of people hanging out there, eating, sleeping. But the depiction of Indonesian national history stops at 1998. So there is no idea, and this was an interpretation under the new order that promoted the idea of the military, that cemented the glory sort of role that this organization had within Indonesian history. And then I spoke to somebody else and said, hey, what's going on with Indonesia's history textbooks. Okay, maybe the military might be pushing this idea that it's this awesome figure within Indonesian history, but on the education side, are they getting any other alternative narrative? Are they being taught anything about what the military did? And the answer was no. The old textbooks are being used, and there have been plans under Jokowi to reform that, but it hasn't quite happened yet. So this is just the product of some of my inquiries as to why I think that nostalgia has been so stubbornly rooted in Indonesian civilian perceptions, in addition to the aggressive way in which the military is promoting itself as this guardian of the state. Again, I mean, I wish Flavia were here, then we could talk a little bit about Brazil. But one of the things is that, is this limited to Indonesia? What's going on globally? And there have been signs globally that there has been this nostalgia for the strong man. In Brazil, under Jair Bolsonaro, there's been this idea that the military should have a bigger role in politics. 43% support a temporary revival. Very interestingly, Brazil had a military authoritarian leadership about the same time Indonesia did as well, and they crushed the communists. In the Philippines, you've got President Rodrigo Duterte, who will happily use the police force as his private hit squad, who's killed anywhere between 6,000 or up to 20,000 people. 80% approval rating. And that's a very difficult thing to explain as well. But again, globally, there seems to be a decline amongst citizens, not only in established democracies, but post-authoritarian democracies, for democracy as a system at gross dissatisfaction. So again, how can we situate the Indonesian case amongst some of these global trends? So what does this mean for Indonesia? So you've got the military encroaching in a lot of areas of civilian life and politics. You've got civilians, on the other hand, that say, we really love the military, we really trust the military. And so what? Does that really matter for Indonesia? Well, I would say, obviously, I'm going to say yes, but let me enumerate the reasons why. So first and foremost, I want to say, yes, while the military has got greater and greater influence, there's no risk of a coup because they don't need a coup. The military and the civilians have comfortably co-opted each other, and that would be not in the military's interest to formally step into politics, because why should they? They have everything they need. They've got influence within the president, they have their physical presence through the archipelago, and they have their business interests intact. So there is no point expending any kind of the goodwill they've generated amongst the population by formally extinguishing democracy there. However, the military's pervasive presence does have an eroding effect on democratic norms and accountability if they are not going to be treated fairly in front of the law, as we saw with the special forces soldiers, as one example. And there is a further erosion of trust in institutions like the Corruption Eradication Commission, amongst others. And again, like I said, that socialization of a military mindset dealing with internal security means they're going to be coming at some of these issues quite hard and less likely to be accounting for a human rights or a human security approach as well. Just to go back to the map of Indonesia, just want to give you a sheer idea of the spread of those islands. Yes, we've got a land focus, but this is an archipelagic nation that should have a maritime focus. So the impact of having that land dominance is that you don't have that maritime focus that Indonesia should have. It's got, you know, the stripping of natural resources through illegal fishing, which costs something like $5 billion Australian dollars a year, given that a lot of their livelihood is dependent on a lot of that protein as well. Trafficking, kidnapping, you've got critical infrastructure offshore, and then you've had China's recent incursions into the EZ. We'll talk about that in the Q&A if you like. But my argument here is that by having so many of these army generals around the president in key decision-making positions in the bureaucracy is a reinforcement of a strategic culture that is predominantly land-focused. And having a minister of defense that comes from the military, again, civilians will say, like, well, look, if I can't actually make it to minister, why would I even try joining the bureaucracy? Just on a side note, I've actually asked young Indonesians, would you join the Ministry of Defense or would you join the Ministry of Affairs? And by and large, they said to me, I wouldn't even bother joining the Ministry of Defense. So that means the Ministry of Defense in Indonesia is not getting the cream of the crop of university graduates. They're all going to other government departments. And an interesting fact behind that is if you apply for a job in the Indonesian bureaucracy, you can only apply for one ministry at a time. So no one's going to bother applying for the Ministry of Defense. And I've actually asked defense colleagues about that. Like, does it not concern you that you're not getting good civilian recruits? I'm like, no, not really. So again, there is actually practical barriers there for good civilian capacity, good civilian decision-making within that bureaucracy. So again, and surprise, surprise, what do you end up getting? You end up getting a defense white paper that is produced by the ministry that names land-based threats as those most acute for Indonesia. And like I said, there is some credence to the fact that there are land-based threats, but again, a lot of that discourse is reinforced by the way in which the military operates. and the sorts of things that they're doing and saying again. So let me just skip ahead to the impact on military capabilities. So I've said there's been an impact on democratic norms, an impact on strategic thinking within the nation state, a physical impact, actual material impact on military capability. Again, a pushing of land forces means less money in the budget for a Navy and Air Force, which does little to bolster its maritime defences. Again, and that rivalry between the military and police can also mean less resources for the police as well and more for the army. So again, the situation doesn't look like it's going to get any better. The impact on the civilian realm, again, like I said, no proper oversight. Thankfully, for now, Indonesia's media remains quite strong and quite liberal, so we'll see. But again, the Indonesian military's impact on being able to shape that, take books off people, particularly books on communism, tell people they can't wear T-shirts with sickles and hammers, that actually happened, is not exactly what you would expect or you would want in a civil society that is a democratic society as well. Now, while I've painted a really nasty picture of what I think the Indonesian military is doing in Indonesian politics and the state, I do want to make one argument that it is not all bad news. As I said earlier, Indonesia has a poverty rate of about 10%, and its citizens are on average earning about 6,000 Australian dollars, and it has a Gini coefficient that is quite high. In other words, there's a big disparity between rich people and poor people as well. But it is a country that is prone to natural disasters. In particular, not unusual for Australia, but drought, flooding, excess rainfall. If anyone's been to Jakarta and seen how it's flooded, it can be quite crippling for their economy. But also that the World Food Programme estimates that 20 million Indonesians are not gaining sufficient nutrition as well. So what the president has done is actually said to the military, right, you are logistically well prepared and you have the capacity to help deliver food security to the Indonesian people. Again, for better or for worse, its physical presence throughout the territory allows it to be able to do things like plant rice. Now, again, that's not necessarily what we would want because that takes away from the ability to develop civilian capacity. But when you have an institution that is able to respond to some of these challenges in an immediate sense, I find it very difficult to say that that is a bad thing in the immediate sense. Okay, it's not what we want in the long term, but I do want to flag that there are circumstances under which the Indonesian military's role that goes above and beyond external security or even internal security can be a good thing. And again, under climate-related change, as weather patterns intensify with climate change, that would be a creative area for Australia to think about. And again, you know, the military's role in HADR, humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, is a critical one in Indonesia. That's just some of the aftermath of some of the earthquakes that happened in Central Sulawesi in 2018. We've got the military commander there dealing with some of the disaster relief agency people. But again, the military has that physical presence. So is this going to change in the future? So I've talked about why this matters, and you've seen how that encroachment of the military might impact on the different areas of Indonesian society and politics, but is that actually going to change? And as I said earlier, there is a lot of handover in belief system between an older generation and a younger generation. So while younger officers are not necessarily interested, and some of them actually abhor the way in which some of their seniors were involved in politics at the time, this is still an ongoing process. So we'll see where that heads. Another factor that might change is if there's some sort of crisis within Indonesian economics or society, as we saw in the 1997-1998 East Asian financial crisis. And if the military is seen as being involved in that, then that will work against them. But for now, no shocks as yet. We may see something like coronavirus, which hasn't been found in Indonesia. We'll talk about that in a second. But also another factor might be a growing consolidation of religious conservatism and the movement within military factions. This is a difficult one to watch, but this is something that I just want to flag because there are certain military groups that do want to support the state ideology of Pancasila, which means a plurality of religions, plurality of recognition within the state, and those that actually are empathetic with ideas of having Islamic law. So again, I'm just going to flag that for now. It's still something to watch. And again, in a positive note, other changes might be precipitated by through reform in the education curricula and the ability to have robust public discussion about what the military has done in this past. But until those things happen, I personally don't forecast substantial change in the status quo. In fact, I would argue there'll be a further intensification throughout Jokowi's presidency. So here's the important question, of course. What does this mean for us? Well, for better or for worse, Indonesia remains, according to our foreign policy white paper, our defence white papers, and even the recent meeting between Scott Morrison and Jokowi, an important partner for Australia. Not necessarily in terms of trade. We know that that part of the bilateral relationship remains under Dumba, certainly in strategic terms. and Indonesia remains a key partner in issues like counterterrorism, but also a number of transnational and other human security issues as well. But if that is the case, learning how we might leverage the military's supreme role might be advantageous to us. We are also experiencing climate change-related intensification of weather patterns. Indonesia is also experiencing the intensification of climate change-related patterns. And so learning how to creatively tap into the fact that the military, Indonesian military, is pervasive throughout the archipelago, can they be involved in tree planting programs? Can they be involved in helping to clean up the oceans? Is there a role, which there has been, actually, Jokowi has said he wants the military to become a testbed for biofuels. Are there more creative ways for us to be able to support and engage some of those processes for a country that is experiencing a lot of vulnerability from climate change? Also, that would involve us cleaning up our climate change policy. So I'm talking in very ambitious terms. But again, thinking more creatively, the situation may not be ideal from the perspective of similar military relations, but from other areas, our other interests like climate change, could we work with that situation for now? Again, we'll always have to work with the Indonesian military in terms of defense cooperation, and by and large, we privilege the army. The question of whether we ought to be doing that and what ways is that actually privileging the role within the military is something that we should still continue to discuss, and how we might play a role in continuing to strengthen the maritime capabilities is another area. But again, as I said earlier, the pervasive influence of the Indonesian military and the impact on democratic norms is actually, I think, the area of most critical concern. And the ways in which Australia can leverage its bilateral cooperation, setting up scholarships for journalists, for supporting transparent and robust research processes, lifting the number of research institutions and supporting Indonesia's desire to have more PhD graduates in their country are certainly areas that we could continue to do. Ultimately, the way in which Indonesia's military is operating society will continue to move the way it will. It's not a process that we can necessarily stop. This is the former Indonesian Armed Forces commander Gatot Numantio taking a bike ride with Jokowi in the Papuan provinces. And I just wanted to say that Indonesia's going to go the way it's going to go. And so what does the Indonesian case tell us? As I said, the Indonesian military is going to continue to play that important role, that expanded role in Indonesia, whether we like it or not. Yes, militaries have deleterious effects on democratic norms and the functioning of bureaucracies. I think the Indonesian case will continue to inform us on that, and there's still more research that can be done. I want to highlight that it is often not always the case that just because a military is stepping outside those anticipated roles, that it is always a bad thing. Again, we have to take into account what the Indonesian people are asking for and what their needs are. But again, I think thinking about how this happens to the country on North helps us understand better in a more nuanced and a more realistic sense, how militaries are actually operating within post-authoritarian democracies as well. We've got our sets of beliefs of what we think should happen. Indonesia's military has its own set of beliefs about what it thinks should happen, and ultimately so does Indonesian society. And how we reconcile all of these three groups will ultimately determine the kind of relationship that we have between our two countries. Thank you.
Very convincing, and I hope that there are still some questions because, yeah, everything you said made a lot of sense, but hoping that there are some questions that we can lead off with. Molly, we'll hand the microphone around. We'll just start down.
Hi, thank you very much for that very interesting presentation. I'd like to ask about the military's role during the time of President Yudhoyono, and whether it was as strong and growing in that time, or has it really been a rising again because of the relative political weakness of Jokowi? And the other question I had was about, you referred to the misinformation campaign being waged by the military, for instance, in regard to the Papuan provinces, if you could talk about that.
I'll address the first question. The first question was the military as strong under the previous president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, or is it the fact that there are a re-rising of the military today? I would argue that actually there was a very strong military influence under President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono. I mean, he himself was a military general. He himself comes from a long legacy of a military family. His wife comes from a military family, and in fact her father, SBY's father-in-law, played a very important role in the new order. So if you actually see it from that perspective, these are members of old military families who then continue to have influence in a democratic Indonesia. SPY was a reformer, but that pedigree, I think, is still actually important to note as well. And around him, he continued to have other military officers as key advisors and key roles. The difference is that actually in the defense portfolio, he actually had civilians. There was a gentleman called Professor Giovanni Sudisono who actually advocated for there to be greater civilian participation in security and defense matters. And they actually set up a defense university during this time to try and get the next generation of civilian strategic thinkers through a master's program and a PhD program. The university is now run by a military officer. So we're back to where we started in some ways. But what I would argue is under the Jokowi era, you have a greater visibility of those generals around him. As you said, he's a little bit weaker on that side, and he needs to make some of those political bargains by having military support and also the lack of knowledge. But like I said, there are other sort of structural reforms, legal reforms, and the increase of budget into certain areas that have actually allowed, I think, the army in particular to gain a stronger foothold than it did in the SPY era. SPY was very much interested in having the military out there, flying the Indonesian flag, going on peacekeeping operations. And I think today there's a lot more of an intensification of the military's domestic role under Jokowi. Oh, and the second question, the misinformation campaign in Papua. So there have been some excellent reports recently coming out of Bellingcat, ASPIE, and BBC that looked into the ways in which the Indonesian military used Twitter and Facebook to drown out pro-independence support in Papua. So just quickly, there have been pro-independence groups in Papua that have been fighting for independence since the 1960s. And a lot of them have been using social media to kind of talk about the ways in which the military has not been behaving correctly in the provinces to try and put their messages out there. There was an instance recorded where the military flooded, one particular army cyber unit flooded the internet with particular hashtags and particular messages saying that, what's going on isn't true, the killings weren't done by the military. There's all these sorts of messages that we're trying to drown out the same way in which bots may have done the same during the US election to try and to use a sheer numbers to try and distort that from a number of fake accounts and things like that. So the investigation was done that showed a lot of these accounts weren't real. They were all, I think, the same parent company that was owned by the military. I think you can go and find the report online. But what it was basically trying to do was a systematic attempt to try and drown out a lot of those Papuan voices and replace them with pro-military positive messages. And not the first time.
You wouldn't mind just introducing yourself as well?
Sure. Hi, that very interesting presentation. My name's Mark Brisky. I'm from Murdoch University. In another life, I was posted to the Australian Embassy in Jakarta, and also in the High Commission in Pakistan. And I couldn't help but find similarities in the whole notion of how you've described Indonesia, the Indonesian military, and their creation of a strategic culture and a strategic narrative with very close similarities to what's occurred in Pakistan, except they've externalised an external enemy being India. And also notions of Laswell's garrison state and Praetorianism. But what I was interested in is in Pakistan, there's a particular ethnic dimension to the military where the Punjabi, the officer corps are dominated by a Punjabi elite. I was wondering, have you in your research seen anything like that in Indonesia, whether it's sometimes people allege a Javanization of Indonesia? Do you see that as a factor in the military elite in Indonesia?
Yes, absolutely. Do you want to take any while on that one? Good. So this is an interesting area that I want to look into. It's going to be quite difficult. But I would say, anecdotally, the military senior officer corps are predominantly Javanese, although there are a lot of senior Batak officers. So look at Binsa Pajayatan, comes from a particular part of Sumatra. The Batak officers tend to be Christian. But by and large, a lot of the senior officer corps of the Indonesian military are Muslim. And they are Javanese. I don't think I've ever seen a senior military officer from Chinese background, ethnically Chinese Indonesian, despite the fact that, ethnically Chinese have been there. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that they were associated with the communism. So again, there are lots of historical legacies that have shaped the military. But again, Javanese make up the most of them. They do have an idea of an elite within Java, not only within military circles, but political circles as well. It's often said that you probably would never have a non-Javanese president in Indonesia. And I think the same kind of goes for the military as well. There was an anomalous period during the New Order where you had Benny Madani, who was the commander, who was a Christian. And I don't think that that would ever happen again. Not likely in any case. But what I'm also interested in, it's not just constellations of ethnicity, but as I said earlier, like family legacy. You know, you can see some of the relationships that are forming there in terms of military factionalism, and which faction do you fall in depending on which sort of family grouping. And of course, those allegiances can change over time according to business interests. But as I said earlier, an emerging area of interest for me is how military factionalism might be fracturing according to different groups in terms of their adherence to the state ideology of Pantasilla, or where they may express greater sympathies with perhaps other forms of state organisation that may involve things like Islamic law as well. So that's an emerging area, but certainly, yes, there are those ethnic ties.
Mark Beeson from UWA. Thanks very much for your presentation, Natalie. It was great. I've got a couple of questions. One is about the... this is a sort of technical question, I guess, but is it still true that the military doesn't receive enough money from the central government to actually pay for all of its interests and just running the military as an institution? And in your list of interests of the military at the beginning of your presentation, you didn't mention making money, and that's something that they are pretty interested in. And maybe it's partly functional, maybe it's partly because they're a bit entrepreneurial. But I just wondered, given that it's one of the few really national competent institutions that exists across the country, is the government on the one hand willing to turn a blind eye to some of its off, its slightly less legitimate activities? And also because it is, when at times of disaster and other times, it is one of the most reliable institutions they can call on to actually do a useful job as well. So there's a sort of tacit agreement between the government and the military about how things work.
Thanks for your question, Mark. It's a very difficult one to study. A lot of the research that has gone into the military's budget and its self-financing, the last major studies were done about 10 years ago. And I think things have become much, much harder to access, even for journalists. What I can say is that the military signing of MOUs, like the one I alluded to earlier with Freeport-McMoRan, is an avenue of financing for them as well. So it's a revenue stream in addition to some of the budget. But you're right, the military, you know, as we saw earlier, some of the figures, you know, the Indonesian military has half the budget allocation of the Australian military. And again, as I said, some of that accounts for the fact that Australia has a lot of high-end military platforms that are very expensive. But the size of the Indonesian military and what they're earning is not nearly enough. The military has tried by formal means and informal means to continue revenue raising. One of the things I talked about when I said that the Indonesian president wants the military to do things like get into biofuels, I also didn't talk about the fact that the Indonesian Navy has been involved in fuel smuggling. And other kinds of activities like that. That's very low level. That's not going to be getting a lot of money. What will get you a lot of money is that if you're an army commander and you go out into the provinces and then you contract out your soldiers to do all sorts of different other activities. And so that's seen as what they call in Indonesia a very wet kind of position, where as an individual you can earn a lot of money and then in some sort of period of formation get that filtered down into your command. And so if you've been given one of those regional commands, you're probably going places. It's been done as something good for you, and then in turn you try and earn that money as well. So again, a lot of the research on this is very difficult to determine in terms of, you know, asking, you don't really ask people like, hey, how much did you earn last year out in that regional command? But we are aware of these kinds of activities that the military engages in both a formal and an informal sense as well. But yeah.
Thank you. Rhys Young, from the Australian Army, actually. And don't worry, I don't hold any portfolios here in the government. I took away from what you were talking about that we're looking at a young state, 20 years democracy, a large population, disparate, you know, across the archipelago, a 10% also poor, you know, 20 million odd people, so and therefore low education standards, that sort of thing. And then, yeah, at the same time, we're seeing 5% growth in their GDP, so something's going right economically for the nation. My question, I guess, is there a role of, is self-identity in the state of Indonesia playing out here, and so the military is seen as the backbone or the only large, centrally organised, prevalent structure in this area, which is a good employer. You know, pays its people, educates its people, keeps them healthy. So you'd want your sons and daughters to join it. They are the backbone in HADR, that sort of thing. But also, it's a country where self-identity in a one Indonesia is perhaps not there like it is in Australia, you know, where people are more loyal to their own family, tribal groups and ethnicity as well. Do you think that that has something to play here?
I'm not sure I understand the question. If you could just reword it slightly,
yeah,
please.
Okay. Indonesia, large yeah. country, multitude of groups mm-hmm. that are in there. It's very young. And so when you have a state that doesn't identify as a singular entity, that there's a lot of sub-states inside it, and across those sub-states is a single entity, then perhaps that is the logical structure that you turn to run your country.
Yep.
Australia for many years was like that post-colonisation. So,
yeah, no, you're right. It's interesting. I think what you're actually asking about is about nationalism in some ways or another. Yeah, and you're right. I mean, Indonesia does have a lot of fault lines according to different religions, regions, business interests that are masked as ethnic issues. And so there are definitely, I mean, I've been talking about the military as a monolith. I think I've separated that out in terms of active and retired, but again, yeah, there are different parts of the military, intra-service rivalry, but then again, regional sorts of rivalries as well. There have been cases where the military has recruited only from particular provinces, and so you do have a concentration of particular kinds of interests. There was a case recently where some land was given back, was taken by the government in Papua, and the Papuan people said, right, if you're going to take our land, we want the military to recruit our sons and daughters, because at least gives us, you know, an alternative for income, prestige, education, all that kind of stuff. So there is a sense of the military, you know, as an employer of choice in that regard. But the military has also been used as not only a tool of nationalism when you're recruiting people into the institution, but to be able to do things like teach basic military training to people. The first defense minister under Jokowi's cabinet, Riam Izzat Rukudu, former army general, actually proposed a program called Bela Negara, defend the nation. And as part of that program, he wanted civilians to get basic military training, boot camp, basically, from the military. So it was actually, you know, pushing forth a form of nationalism, but using the military in that regard as well, because trusted institution, pervasive institution, it's kind of cool for people to go to this kind of military boot camp. Even our, you know, sports boot camps, now we say boot camp, you know, we use militaristic terms. It's not just Indonesia, but it was a way of getting people to kind of come together and support Pancasila, the state ideology, to support the military by having that contact. So, yes, the military can be used in that way as well.
Natalie, I'm just wondering from your research what Indonesians living outside of Indonesia think about the military system, and do they have some of the same concerns as what you have, or are they previously indoctrinated? You know, how does that sort of play out compared to people that live in Indonesia and don't get to travel outside or study abroad?
Yeah, that's hard to say. I mean, a lot of the time when you're talking about people abroad, they're probably middle class. If they're living in the United States, Australia or Europe, they've had the means first to migrate and then are living in countries, particularly Australia, where you have a base level of social welfare and do have different kinds of views. That's no guarantee that they will necessarily align more with a more Western democratic normative idea of how the military should behave. But by and large, anecdotally, there have been surveys that show that a lot of people in diasporas, Indonesian diasporas, are pro-Jokowi. But pro-Jokowi doesn't necessarily mean not pro-military. As we've seen, Jokowi now comes with, you know, a very militarized, military-esque type coterie. But it's certainly the case. I don't think there's a lot of support for the way in which things were like under the new order. But again, that might be the product of the fact that a lot of people who've migrated are people who did not have a very good time under the new order, a lot of people of ethnic Chinese ethnic background. And so from their perspective, they may not have had a very good relationship with the military as well, but it's hard to generalise.
Hi, my name's Mike Vosper. I'm a new student at Curtin, International Relations. I had a question on the 2015 threats. Separatism was mentioned there. and interested in Papua. Why wouldn't what's the Indonesians' desire to hold on to that territory, not just let it go?
Yeah, good question. A lot of it is about resources. And I talked about Freeport McMoRan as a massive gold mine there, amongst other things. There's timber, amongst others. But again, there's many questions about the legitimacy of the Act of Free Choice that was done in 1963, this alleged vote by the Papuan people, representatives of the Papuan people that said they wanted to join the Indonesian state. So there's a question about the legitimacy of that. But the fact is, after some time, after the many decades that the Indonesian state has invested into keeping that province, having gone through the experience of losing East Timor, having gone through the experience of fighting the insurgency in Aceh and making that stay as part of the archipelago, I think it would be almost inconceivable in an existential way for the Indonesian military, let alone the state, to let go of Papua now. And part of that fear is about the precedents that it would set for separatism for other kinds of provinces, or at least the leverage that would provide a lot of the other provinces to say, well, if they're going to separate, you've given them better benefits and stuff, why not us? And that has happened in the past. But I think now, like I said, there's practical reasons in terms of resources, and then there are other strategic reasons of losing that kind of territory, which Indonesia probably wouldn't want, and having what would be an unstable area on its doorstep. I mean, it's got PNG there. Timor-Leste is still coming to terms, with being its own independent state, and there's always concern about China becoming an influencing force, or there is concern about China becoming an influencing force in South Pacific. I don't think Indonesia would want another unstable area on its doorstep. And then lastly, this, the emotional tie, the existential reasons why it would never let it go.
You've made me very curious there as to the, what would Australia's position be if there was a conflict that broke out just once? Another one.
Yeah, sure. So the question was, what would Australia...
What would our position be?
Oh, okay. Well, that's fun. I think you can look to Timor as the precedent. It depends, because from an Australian strategic point of view, it is not an Australian... And I'm parroting a line here, which is Australia is not... It's not in Australia's interest to see parts of the Indonesian state break up. And that does not mean that the Australian state, and I'm not talking about NGO groups, the Australian public, the Australian state does not have concern for human rights abuses or the way in which the level of development has unfolded in Papua. Yeah. But from an Australian strategic perspective, from a government perspective, it is not advantageous. So it would be, as I've said this before, it would take some sort of unfortunate and horrible massacre or something, some sort of critical event that would necessitate a change of Australian government policy. And until that happens, and we've seen, the outbreak of violence multiple times throughout Papua, there was another outbreak of violence when there were a group that attacked some miners and then there was a retaliation by the military. It's still nothing. So again, that threshold is getting higher and higher, but until it satisfies the requirements of Australian politicians and bureaucrats and decision makers to overturn the policy of Indonesian state, it's not going to happen.
Hi, I'm struck by how active the Indonesian military is in shaping public opinion. And you mentioned the social media campaign in Papua. My question is, how active are they in social media in the rest of Indonesia? And how important is social media in influencing Indonesian politics?
Oh my God, so much. Jakarta is one of the largest Twitter cities in the world. A lot of people get their information about politics from WhatsApp, amongst other things, Facebook. And it's not just because, in practical terms, Indonesia's infrastructure is so difficult in terms of transport and logistics that people spend a lot of time on their phones. It's the way that they connect with people. You can buy... Okay, so you have Instagram and you're a small business. You can sell your product on Instagram. The person makes a payment through a mobile phone transfer. You then get the delivery sent by Gojek, which is like an Uber-like app, and you don't even have to move. Like, all of those transactions happen in the social media domain, and that is a lot of the way in which some of the commerce is done in Indonesia. So that's just on the commerce side. Like, on the social side, huge. And so the Indonesian military, its information, what's the name of it? Its public relations arm is particularly active. on Facebook, through Instagram, all of its multiple social media accounts. All of the regional commands, district commands have their own social media accounts. A lot of the senior officers have Instagram, actively promote. They've got very slick video campaigns, lots of YouTube, sort of like dramatic music, all this other stuff. So they know how to package themselves. Again, it's very hard necessarily to measure uptake, because it's one thing to put information out there. It's another thing to sort of see how is that information being received. But by and large, I think some of the anecdotal evidence can be for that, the favorable reviews that the military gets. It's part of that picture. You can't just say because the military has really cool social media that they're a trusted institution, but it is part of promoting what it does, which allows people to gain a perception that it is a trusted institution. And I'm not saying, again, that it is the factor, because, again, like I said, from an early age, people are seeing the military all the time, but it is a factor in shaping that belief, I think.
Mike Brennan, I'm a retired Army officer, as you know. I had some involvement in the ADF operations in East Timor around 1999, 2000, 2001. And I was quite taken by the war, the commemoration, the memorial to the service of the T&I in East Timor. I'm just wondering how things are today. So is there military-to-military engagement between Timor-Leste and Indonesia? And if so, is that done on a nation-to-nation level, or is it done from the local province then across the border into Timor-Leste? Thank you.
So it's really interesting. Despite the fact that the Timorese people suffered greatly at the hands of the Indonesian military and the Indonesian state, the relationship, bilateral relationship between Timor-Leste and Indonesia, I would argue, is more favourable than the relationship that Timor-Leste and Australia have, or Indonesia and Australia have. And a lot of the time, some senior military officers will say to me, they were a part of us, they are our brothers, we have good relations. Part of that is the fact that under SBY, when Xanana Gusmão was president, he and Xanana actively worked to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to do all of the, you know, the paperwork and say, yeah, we're done with it. We've got our report there. And there are lots and lots of photographs of them hugging and kissing and saying, we're all good now. We're all going to be good friends. Indonesia is now an active supporter of Timor-Leste joining ASEAN, the Association for Southeast Asian Nations. So that sets the tone at the national level. And the military-to-military relationship is actually very good. And it's interesting, given that you've got a lot of the bulk of the Timorese military having been the former freedom fighters of Falantil, who are now cooperating with TNI. So former adversaries now cooperating. And that military cooperation extends down from their National Resilience Institute, where they send senior military officers, command and staff college, service to service, and then even Indonesian military cadets. And there's some training between the engineers as well. So it's starting. And if I'm not mistaken, I think the Indonesian Navy might be transferring patrol boats to Timor, I'm not sure, or even PT, the Indonesian shipbuilding company, PT PAL. But it's a nascent relationship, but it's a functional and it's a healthy relationship, I think. I mean, and in a sense, like Timor-Leste probably also needs a lot of help on the maritime side. But again, the Timor-Leste military is so small at the moment that there's not a lot that it can do with the Indonesian military because it's so strapped for cash as well.
Okay, well, while we get the microphone to Cameron to do our lovely thanks, I'm just wondering if you could comment on, the picture that you've got up here. I feel like there's some thought that's gone into this.
Oh, there's that one.
No,
it's just a bit of a warmer. No, but I will go to this one. This is a piece of art by an artist called Hendra Gunawan that shows the battle for Diponegoro. I just wanted to highlight as a fact, a lot of the Indonesian military uses a lot of Sanskrit terminology and a lot of the idea of this knights of Kshatriya and all this other stuff, and a lot of the mythology of the old kingdoms and sultanates of Indonesia. Some of that mythology has been infused back into the current Indonesian military of today. And so one of the commands of the Indonesian military is called the Diponegoro Command, again, harking back to this sort of like ancient history. So yeah, the Indonesian state's only been around since 1945, but the way in which the Indonesian military creates its longer legacy and culture is drawing on a lot of these Sanskrit mythologies and a lot of these old figures as well. So I thought this one was more interesting.
Yeah, so on behalf of the AAA, I would like to extend our thanks to you for coming here tonight. I think all of us were very interested to hear how you broke down the Indonesian military and talked specifically about the demographics and how people's past experiences now affecting Indonesia's public policy. public policy and military. So we would like to offer you a small token of thanks for coming here tonight. Thank you so much.